attacks on hospitals in Gaza are endangering the lives of newborn babies. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the first story today takes us to Syria, where the Syrian army says it is preparing for a counterattack against foreign-backed terrorists in the country's Aleppo and Idlib provinces after militants took control of parts of the volatile area there. In a statement, the army said armed clashes with the terrorists have prompted the Syrian military to strengthen the defense lines in an effort to preserve the lives of civilians. Now, the statement added that the army will continue its operations to confront and expel the terrorists and to restore control of those areas. Clashes between the Syrian army and the terrorists began after the Takfiri groups, including the al-Nusra Front, launched a surprise multi-front attack on the northern parts of the Arab country on Wednesday. Syria has been gripped by foreign-backed militancy since early 2011, which caused widespread damage to the country's infrastructure and mass displacements. We're going to cross over to Damascus, joined by Ibrahim Wahdi. Ibrahim, good to see you. Well, fill us in on the latest situation that is taking place there.
Yes, Marzia. As you mentioned, the terrorist groups located in Idlib and Aleppo Western countryside have launched a wide-scale attack on Wednesday against Syrian army positions and villages and towns in Western Aleppo countryside and in Aleppo city, and on Aleppo city itself. And the past few days, let's say, the attack was confronted by the Syrian Arab Army, and as we said earlier, the Syrian Arab Army inflicted heavy losses among the ranks of the terrorists who were attacking. But the latest development in the past hours, the militants, after making a breach yesterday to the city in a small area in a few towns, they managed, unfortunately, to get in the city entirely. And we need here to explain something for people to understand. First, the Syrian, the general command of the Syrian Arab Army, the army and armed forces, stated that the troops, the Syrian Arab Army troops, had to withdraw to a second defense line in order to preserve lives as much as possible, because they've lost dozens of martyrs in these attacks. And also, the city of Aleppo was evacuated. The city of Aleppo was evacuated from all official and governmental headquarters buildings were evacuated completely, and security also headquarters were completely evacuated and withdrew out of the city. They set a perimeter around the city in order to not repeating the 2012 event. In 2012, there was a decision to defend the city at all costs, no matter what. And that costed a lot lately. That costed a lot of lives, soldiers, civilians, innocent people who were martyred and wounded, and also the huge destruction of the city that everybody knew about. This time, in this different circumstances, regional and international circumstances, obviously, the general command of the army and armed forces took a different decision this time, in order to preserve, in order to save as much lives as possible. They withdrew from the city and kept some of the terrorists get into the city in order to protect the civilian lives from clashes. Now, what happened? The Syrian army has surrounded Aleppo from the east and from the east and the south, while the west, part of the west, while the north has been taken over by the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish militants, This indicates that there has been an agreement between the Syrian state and the Russian forces on the one hand, and the SDF on the other hand, because they've been seen in Aleppo International Airport and in several places. They've been seen now within the city, the SDF forces. They've been seen within the city in several neighborhoods, and there has been some clashes between the SDF forces and the terrorists led by HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. We know that HTS and Turkey, we know that HTS and Turkey are allies, and not just allies. HTS is the tool that Turkey is using at the moment, while SDF and Turkey are sworn enemies. So what's going on at the beginning? There's an internal, let's say, agreement between the Syrian state and the SDF to confront together this of the attack. While further to the south, the Syrian army also withdrew to Murek, north of Hama. It means that the whole area from Murek, to Aleppo, which is more than 100 kilometers long, has been all evacuated.
All right. Okay. I'm sure it's a very, very difficult situation, especially people are remembering what happened in the past. So we'll be checking back with you, Ibrahim, and getting more updates. Appreciate you being with us out of Damascus, Ibrahim Wahdi. Meanwhile, Israel has conducted yet another airstrike on Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and in defiance of international laws. The strike hit the Qusair area of Homs province along the Lebanese border, causing multiple explosions there. There was no immediate report of possible casualties and damage. Over the past days and weeks, Israel has repeatedly targeted various regions of Syria, particularly Homs. Syria has lodged several complaints with the United Nations, accusing the Tel Aviv regime of violating the country's sovereignty, but to no avail. Damascus also accused the Israeli regime of propping up terrorist groups to destabilize the Arab country. Political analyst Tim Anderson joined us earlier from Sydney to share his thoughts on the resurgence of terrorists in Syria amid Israel's aggression against the Arab country.
The Israelis had bombed the border crossings between Lebanon and Syria several times in the past. Now, in recent days, they've done it, killing several people. And the aim is to try and break the nexus between Lebanon, Syria, and Iran and Iraq. So they are petrified of the support that the so-called Axis countries are providing to the Palestinian and the Lebanese resistance. So as soon as the ceasefire and the Israeli withdrawal from parts of southern Lebanon happened, they activated these proxies in northern Syria with the help of their collaborator, Mr. Erdogan. Let's remember, this tells us very much where Mr. Erdogan's, the Turkish leader's politics are these days. He's maintained a steady supply of oil from Baku and Azerbaijan to the Israelis during the whole attack on Gaza. And now he is the main supporter of these armed groups in northern Idlib and northern Aleppo, countryside Aleppo. So he's clearly collaborating very closely with the Israelis and with the US, who are, of course, behind the Israelis. So this is really a NATO-inspired operation to try and weaken the Syrians, to try and weaken that key link of the Axis countries, because the Israelis are petrified of the weapons that are sent through Syria to the resistance, and that they think they can try and break this by killing Iranian officials and bombing Syrian border crossings, and now sending in these horrendous terrorists, Al-Qaeda terrorists, into Aleppo City, which was liberated only 8 years ago.
And now to Turkey, where activists have interrupted a speech by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to protest the country's continued trade ties with Israel. During the speech at the International TRT Assembly, two people protested against Turkey's economic relations with Israel. One of the protesters shouted that our ships are carrying bombs. Another protester questioned, why is Azerbaijani oil going to Israel? Security forces subsequently removed them from the venue. This protest highlights the growing domestic criticism in Turkey regarding the country's ties with Israel. A few months ago, Turkey announced that it had halted trade ties with Israel in response to the Gaza genocide. However, recent reports indicate that Turkey is still maintaining indirect trade relations with Israel. That has led to criticism that the Turkish government is not fully adhering to its own embargo. Well, Saturday has been yet another bloody day for Palestinians in Gaza as deadly Israeli attacks continue to pound the blockaded territory indiscriminately. Starting with southern Gaza, Israeli bombing of a vehicle near Khan Yunis killed at least 17 Palestinians, including workers with the World Central Kitchen. In central Gaza, at least 7 more Palestinians were killed and a number of others injured after Israeli airstrikes targeted residential buildings there. To the north, an Israeli drone strike near Halima al-Sadia School in Jabalia killed at least 1 Palestinian and injured several others. Israeli attacks on 2 residential buildings in Beit Lahia, also in northern Gaza on Friday, killed at least 75 people, most of them women and children. More than 44,300 people have so far been killed since the U.S.-Israeli genocide began in October of 2023. The attacks continue while Gazans are struggling with the lack of food, water, and other basic amenities. Gaza government's media office says Israel has been using hunger as a tool against the Palestinians there, especially women and children. Meanwhile, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, has warned that repeated Israeli strikes on hospitals in Gaza are endangering the lives of newborn babies, calling for an immediate end to such attacks. UNICEF issued the warning after a 3-week-old baby born prematurely died from pneumonia. The organization said the infant's death was a direct result of attacks on medical facilities that prevented the baby from receiving the neonatal intensive care. Since the onset of Israel's war in Gaza, hospitals have been repeatedly bombarded under different pretexts. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, has estimated that around 4,000 babies are expected to be born in Gaza in about a month. This after over a million children are said to be suffering from malnutrition. Israeli bombing and shelling campaign has also knocked 34 hospitals out of service across the besieged territory. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called for an international probe into the Israeli occupation's use of internationally prohibited weapons in northern Gaza. The group said it collected horrific testimonies from doctors and residents in the besieged territory who recounted the evaporation of bodies after Israeli attacks there. Hamas said the accounts strongly indicate that Israel is using internationally prohibited weapons in the, quote, brutal extermination campaign that has been ongoing for 53 days in the northern Gaza Strip. The area has faced relentless Israeli attacks and siege over the past 2 months, during which the regime has systematically blocked the entry of any form of humanitarian aid or food. Well, the Israeli military has intensified its operations in Sinjil, a village in occupied West Bank, to create a buffer zone or buffer zones around Palestinian communities. In this report, we explore the escalating siege faced by villagers and people growing concern over Israel's land confiscation plans.
Sinjil, a small Palestinian village in the central West Bank, is now at the forefront of Israel's military operation to tighten up its grip on Palestinian lands. For 2 months now, Israeli forces have carried out extensive land clearing operations near the village, part of a plan to create buffer zones that isolate communities and control access to vital resources. With the land now under siege, residents fear that they will soon be cut off from the rest of the West Bank.
The wall is part of a broader collective punishment against Sinjil, isolating it from the rest of Palestine and cutting off access to 8,000 dunams of agricultural land. Over 200 families who rely on farming will lose their livelihood, while anyone attempting to reach these lands faces arrest and abuse from Israeli forces and illegal settlers. The area has been sealed off with dirt berms and barbed wire.
The struggle in Sinjar is not new. It has been reignited, reflecting ongoing challenges faced by the Palestinians.
The area is blocked with dirt berms and barbed wire. For decades, we've struggled with the occupation and settlers over control of northern lands, home to four settlements. Since the war, they've used the opportunity to prevent access, and now the wall has crushed any hope of reaching these agricultural lands.
With a population of nearly 20,000, the residents of Sinjar depend heavily on agriculture and livestock. However, they now confront a significant threat as Israel's buffer zones sever their access to vital lands and pastures. As the situation in the occupied West Bank becomes more dire, the people of Sinjar are determined to resist. As Israel presses ahead with its buffer zone plans, the people of Sinjar face an uncertain future. With limited options for resistance, they put up daily struggle to hold on to their homes and their heritage. Naqa Ahmed, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
And it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Instances of mass violence and atrocities reveal many things about the realities of the Western world, exposing power relations in their most brutal, naked form. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, instances of mass violence and atrocities reveal many things about the realities of the Western world, exposing power relations in their most brutal naked form. We learn where states actually stand on controversial issues, how economic structures benefit from mass killing, and how cultural and social institutions are beset by hypocrisy, claiming to stand for human development while allowing the continuing destruction of human life. There has been much analysis of these points since the onset of the Zionist regime's genocidal war against the Palestinian people in Gaza, which has expanded into the occupied West Bank. It reveals a disquieting reality. Political, social, cultural, and economic institutions, especially in the West, are cheering on the genocide. We have seen photos and videos of Zionists laughing, mocking, and generally celebrating the destruction of Palestinian life, while calling for more slaughter and the destruction of critical infrastructure. But such pro-war cheerleading is also taking place outside of the Zionist entity. Pro-Zionist rallies across Europe and North America, along with statements by politicians and their supporters of all stripes, are ripe with examples of pro-genocide cheerleading that are so morally repugnant that they have garnered significant opposition. More widespread are indirect forms of support for the genocide, such as when people express regret for the loss of Palestinian life, but add the caveat that Palestinians have brought this on themselves. Social media is rife with violent messaging that paints the Zionist regime as doing dirty but necessary work supposedly set off by irrational and self-destructive Palestinian violence. Perhaps most devastating, however, is public ambivalence towards the genocide, which in the end is another way of cheering it on because nothing is being done to stop it. This is where many people who hold decision-making positions within institutions lie, especially in universities, where you often hear behind closed doors that senior administrators think that the situation in Palestine is tragic, but there is nothing that they can do to stop it. Ultimately, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS campaign is the only substantive and effective course of action for institutions. The fabricated regime of Israel will not respond to words of condemnation. It will respond only to material, economic, and political pressure. Today, BDS offers the best source of that pressure. Only when people power collectively raises the price of genocide will the settler colonial regime of Israel stop committing it. The only other way to stop it is by waging war on the child killer regime of Israel. There is no third option. Many university administrators in the Western world are quick to dismiss BDS as something that is not possible and should not be adopted. This usually comes under the guise of being a realist, nuanced, and attentive to the safety of Jewish communities in the West. But such talking points are vacuous and have been thoroughly debunked by scholars and activists for decades. This is not an intellectual argument, but rather an attempt to conceal naked self-interest. Even if people believe that their decision to eschew BDS is based on the tropes, the truth is that for most, the real reason behind their inaction on Palestine is that they do not view it as being in their self-interest, as individuals or as representatives of institutions to oppose the Zionist regime. It is no secret that pro-Zionist lobby groups operate with a carrot and stick approach. Opposition to the Zionist regime invites severe backlash from these groups, which have weaponized the charge of anti-Semitism in service of the Zionist regime. Avoiding this backlash and the harm it may cause to the institutions and careers is the main reason for avoiding BDS. Certainly, some universities have an economic incentive to maintain their relationships, agreements, and investments with the Zionist institutions and the various organs of the Euro-American imperial machine that supports it, such as the weapons and defense industries. But even universities that do not have such ties are unwilling to adopt BDS, a position that can only be logically explained by their fear of attacks from pro-Zionist lobby groups and governments. Like the Zionist regime itself, we do not believe such individuals can be convinced of this path through moral condemnation or intellectual arguments. They must also be pressured. So what kind of pressure can be applied to universities and faculty associations to adopt BDS? To put it simply, their self-interest is to avoid a crisis of legitimacy. Increasingly, student activists are not just naming and shaming universities in the US, Canada, the UK, and other countries for not living up to their own ideals when it comes to Palestinian rights. Instead, students are describing these institutions as complicit in the colonization of Palestine and the genocide of the Palestinian people. As Western universities continue to ignore people's demands, defect is a challenge to the legitimacy of these very institutions. We are now witnessing a shift in public discourse, as more people are coming to view them as organs of colonialism, racism, and imperialism, catching up with what many Palestinian, indigenous, black, and anti-imperial scholars and activists have argued for decades. This rift between students and universities will likely widen if these institutions continue to ignore the demand for BDS. Without pressure, the fabricated regime of Israel has calculated that it has nothing to lose by committing genocide. If universities continue to repress demands for justice, then the call to burn it all down will grow stronger until this actually happens, not through a literal burning, but through people withdrawing their support and participation from these institutions. Such pressure can take many forms, but the end result is the same, a crisis of legitimacy. So to avoid this outcome, universities must begin to work together and respond to students' demands. In a strong coalition, they can put real pressure on their governments. The current approach of vilifying student protesters and working closely with the state to suppress these movements might produce the desired results in the short term. But recent events have changed the public's political consciousness for a long time to come. We know from history that when people no longer view their institutions as legitimate, unpredictable consequences can emerge. When this happens, the universities will have only themselves to blame, and they should be reminded of the moment in which they cheered on a genocide.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani. He's going to explain the book Islamic Beliefs, Reclaiming the Narrative. This book contains the lectures delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei prior to the Islamic Revolution, and it focuses on revisiting the sacred scripture to better understanding the true purpose of faith, consequently changing the way we see life and the world around us.
So, brothers and sisters, as I mentioned last time, or in the beginning of the speech, this year we'll be talking about Islamic dignity. Our focus is on tarbiyah, raising those soldiers of the Mahdi, those practical steps that we have to take as a community. But having said that, since we're on the discussion of karama, dignity, Islamic self-worth, and this is something we find from the ayat of the Quran, it would seem inappropriate to ignore current events. Allow me to say something about current events, but it's regarding this verse of the Quran. So we're talking about being valued, right? Valued by God. In Surah Isra, so Surah 17, and verse number 70, this is what God says. وَلَكَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ. That we, Allah says, we definitely granted honor and dignity to the children of Adam. God granted karama to the children of Adam. When you see something like this as a red line for us in Islam, then we understand what this war is all about for the people in Palestine. This is about dignity, karama, their value as human beings. This is a right that can't be negotiated with. This is a war that can't end in anything other than victory for the resistance. We're talking about human beings, Bani Adam. God granted karama. We will never go under the boots of the Zionists. Genocide Joe, the Zionist Nazis, they need to understand this. This is not, we can't ever compromise on this. The axis of resistance won't allow that. Our brothers in Yemen, mashallah to our brothers in Yemen, there is no way that they're going to allow these Bani Adam, these children of Adam, to be starved to death. Our brothers and sisters in Palestine, they're resisting, but they're starving. But not, that's not something that we can compromise on. That war, no matter how terrible the price, because it's karama, then as you know, is not something we can compromise on. You see, this is something now for us to tell everyone. We are an ummah that see ourselves as the children of Sayyida Fatima. That includes our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Brothers and sisters, I don't know how many of you have had the opportunity to look and see the words of our Palestinian brothers and sisters yourselves, as an example. Perhaps some of you have heard of Shahid Ibrahim Nablusi. His mother talks about the reverence that he held in his heart for Amir al-Mu'mineen. Perhaps some of you have got a chance to see Jamal ad-Durra, the father of Muhammad ad-Durra, and to see how he talks about Imam Hussein. So for these kind of people, this is just a message to the enemies who take the Ahlul Bayt as being practical role models. There is no way that we can forego an ayat of Quran like this. The resistance will continue to push. We as believers, mu'mineen and mu'minat, will continue to protest and support them until they get their God-given rights back. Inshallah, with salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. For the ummah of the Prophet, the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen are the final decree. He's taught us, if you want to live with dignity, how we should be. These are the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He says this, Al-mawtu fi hayatikum maqhurin. Death is in staying alive, but disgraced, humiliated under the boots of oppressors. On the other side, وَالْحَيَاتُ فِي مَوْتِكُمْ قَاهِرِينَ. But life is in dying, but triumphant, resisting. So this is a lesson for us as an ummah. We will never allow the Palestinians on our watch to be treated with that kind of degradation, and then not that they hear our voices and that we won't support them. The only solution, one, an immediate ceasefire. Two, because they are Bani Adam, we say not to run the Zionist into the sea, a referendum. A referendum means the original inhabitants of Palestine, whatever their deed, those who are in the camps, the diaspora, the original Palestinians, they get to choose one man, one vote, whatever government they choose. Perhaps it'll be like South Africa, where they allowed some of the apartheid regime to stay there. Perhaps no. They say all of them must leave. Whatever it is, the Palestinians have the right to determine their own destiny, to live with dignity. And that's something that we as an ummah will never abandon. Hadith now from the Imam. So this is from Imam Kadhim, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. First of all, the principle, right? What is a kareem-like hadith? Hadith says this, al-mubadaratu ilal-af. So being quick to forgive, he says, min akhlaqil kiram. This is part of the akhlaq of the person who is noble, quick to forgive. So the story is about a time of Imam Kadhim. And the Imam's in Medina at this time. And there's a man who has a habit of bothering the Imam, tormenting the Imam. Even more than that, unfortunately, this man had a habit of saying terrible things about Imam Ali to the Imam. To the extent that one of the companions was with the Imam, and he said, he was serious, he was dead serious. He was like, will you let me take care of this fool the good old-fashioned way? Let me just handle this cat. Right? But the Imam could see there's good in the man. The Imam refused. The Imam asked, he said, where does such and such live, this guy? They said, he lives on the outskirts of Medina. Outskirts of Medina. So the Imam went and he's riding on his donkey. And he gets to this guy's farm. When he gets to the guy's farm, then the guy, when he sees the Imam, he's like, don't tread on my crops! Right? Again. And the Imam didn't say anything, just kept riding his donkey till he gets right over next to the guy. Then the Imam came down off the donkey. They said the Imam joked with him, talked with him a little bit, exchanged some pleasantries. And then the Imam asked him, he said, how much are you hoping to get, how much did you spend on your farm? He said, I spent 100 dinars, 100 gold pieces. I spent that on the farm. The Imam said, how much are you hoping to get from your farm? Inshallah, how much money are you expecting to make from this? And the guy rudely told the Imam, he was like, I don't have ilm al-ghayb. The Imam again, he said, how much are you hoping for? The guy sees the akhlaq of the Imam. He says, I'm hoping, inshallah, I get 300 dirhams. 300 dinars. The Imam takes out a sack of money and hands it to the man. His enemy hands it to him. He said, this is for your farm. He said, but keep the farm. The guy who knows how badly he's treated the Imam, and then he sees this kind of karama, this kind of, you're dealing with my bad actions in this way. The guy starts apologizing. He gets up, he kisses the Imam. The Imam just smiles. He gets back on his donkey. He leaves. Later on that evening, people see, surprisingly, the man is in the masjid of waiting for the Imam. When he comes in, he starts talking good about the Imam. Allah knows better who he placed as leaders. The man's friends start teasing him. You're the same person who's saying all this about. He said, do you see what I'm saying now? He's answering back. He's defending. That evening, later on in that day, the one guy who I mentioned wanted to deal with him the old-fashioned way, he sees the Imam. The Imam said, which way was better? Was the way that you wanted to deal with him, was that better or the way that I dealt with him? So brothers and sisters, inshallah, we will end with that. Inshallah, over the next couple of days, again, trying to define what these things are, how do they apply, what are the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, how do we acquire these things? But we end with salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيم
معنا محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Gaza's civil defense has censured international organizations for their inaction on the suffering of Palestinians amid a genocidal Israeli war on the besieged territory. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor has slammed the international community over its shameful failure to stop Israel's genocide against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. In a statement issued on Sunday, 3rd of November, the group said the European Union, International Criminal Court, ICC, and the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, as well as various United Nations bodies, have neglected their fundamental duty to safeguard civilian life and stop Israel's genocide against Palestinians of Gaza. The statement noted that the failure of the international community to implement decisive actions against Israel's atrocities exposes a stark disregard for Palestinian lives and for Palestinian dignity, and fuels the continuation of its crime of genocide. In an apparent reference to Israel's closest ally, the United States, and other Western countries, the statement attributed the failure to political calculations and the influence of powerful nations complicit in the genocide. The statement added, under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, Israel has committed genocide in Gaza since 7th of October last year, with the United States and Europe complicit by supplying weapons used to massacre Palestinian civilians and demolish their homes. The group noted that the international community and justice mechanisms have largely turned a blind eye to Israel's atrocities. The statement added, at most, some entities have issued weak statements that fail to acknowledge the crimes accurately, emboldening the Israeli regime to escalate its offences with US and European support and armament. Referring to Israel's full-scale invasion and crippling siege of northern Gaza that has been ongoing for nearly a month now, the group said the International Committee of the Red Cross has abdicated its role in this attack. The group added, Israeli military have blocked ambulance and rescue crews in northern Gaza for 10 consecutive days, denying critical services to tens of thousands of people. Hospitals, including the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia, have been targeted, with patients and wounded people martyred, all without intervention from entities like the International Committee of the Red Cross, which has abdicated its responsibilities and its role in this attack. According to the investigation by the Europe Mediterranean Monitor, Israel's actions aim to eradicate the Palestinian people through forced eviction and mass killing, not for military objectives. The group urged the ICC, the International Criminal Court, to issue arrest warrants, prosecute those responsible, and fulfill its mandate to protect Palestinian civilians. It also called on the international community and the United Nations to take an immediate action to prevent further loss of life in northern Gaza and to end Israel's ongoing genocide across the Gaza Strip. The statement also called for a comprehensive arms embargo on the Israeli regime and for holding it accountable because of the crimes that it has committed. Israel launched its brutal war on Gaza on 7th of October last year after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas waged a surprise operation on Al-Aqsa Storm against the occupying regime in response to Israel's decades-long campaign of bloodletting and devastation against the Palestinians. Israel's bloody onslaught on Gaza has so far killed at least 43,500 Palestinians, many of them women and children, and injured over 100,000 others. The website Palestine Studies has also covered this story and tells us more. Gaza's civil defense has censured international organizations for their inaction on the suffering of Palestinians amid a genocidal Israeli war on the besieged territory. Mahmoud Bassal, the agency's spokesman, made the remark on Sunday, 3rd of November, that Israel continues its bloody attacks on the Gaza Strip and impedes the humanitarian response to the catastrophe there. Mahmoud Bassal said, "All our appeals to international organizations and humanitarian institutions have not changed the current situation in Gaza. Our message to the free people of the world is to increase pressure on the international community to enable service providers to fulfill their humanitarian duties." Last month, the Israeli regime intensified its attacks on northern Gaza Strip, cut the area off from the rest of the territory, and blocked nearly all food from entering the region. On Friday, 1st of November, leaders of 15 United Nations agencies and other humanitarian organizations said the situation in northern Gaza was apocalyptic, and that the entire population there is at imminent risk of dying from disease, famine and violence. The United Nations officials also warned that the humanitarian efforts could not keep up with the scale of the needs in northern Gaza. They said basic life-saving goods are not available in northern Gaza, humanitarians are not safe to do their work and are blocked by the Israeli military and by insecurity from reaching people in need. United Nations officials called on the Israeli regime to cease its assault on Gaza and on humanitarians trying to help the people there. Rachel Cummings from Save the Children International also said on Sunday, 3rd of November, the convoys of food and water are being denied access into northern Gaza. Rachel Cummings added, "It is absolutely catastrophic. People are being constantly bombarded with aerial attacks, and of course we know that food and water is not sufficient in northern Gaza." UNICEF, the United Nations Agency for Children, said earlier that more than 50 children were martyred in the attacks on the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza in the past 48 hours. UNICEF said, "Horrific level of child deaths in northern Gaza opens yet another dark chapter in one of the darkest periods of Israel's genocidal war on the Palestinian territory." Furthermore, Mahmoud Bassal said, "More than 100,000 people are left without food, water or medicine in northern Gaza, noting that they're in dire need of life-sustaining resources." Mahmoud Bassal added, "Israel has continuously attacked and bombarded civilian homes, especially in northern Gaza, and destroyed numerous buildings there." He lamented that the Israeli artillery and drones pose a significant threat to the residents of Gaza, instilling constant fear and panic among them. Over the past 400 days, the usurping Zionist regime has refused to allow civilian defense vehicles and equipment to enter Gaza, demonstrating a clear intention to keep the civil defense system paralyzed in the face of emergencies. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a large number of women from across the country. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on December 27, 2023. Now let's look at the topic of women. Well, praise God, we are all knowledgeable, educated, and well aware of the various issues that are raised in Islam regarding the topic of women. There is no need for me to say much on this matter. Nonetheless, I will share a few words with you. Regarding the issue of women, the questions of feminine identity and woman's identity, woman's value, rights, duties, freedoms, and limitations are each crucial and pivotal matters. Today, if we take an overall look at the world, we will see there are two distinct orientations or approaches in all of these areas. The first one is the prevalent Western approach, which has gained popularity in non-Western countries as well, in all the areas that I mentioned. The second approach is the Islamic approach, and these two approaches are in opposition to each other. Each approach has its own perspective and opinions regarding the issues and questions at hand. It is possible to engage in discussions and find answers in all of these areas. However, there is one issue here which I believe deserves our attention, and that is that the West's system of culture and civilization is not willing to discuss these matters. It escapes from entering these discussions and research on women's issues.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Western culture and the Western system, the West's system of civilization and culture, does not come forward to discuss many questions in these areas. Instead, it promotes its viewpoint and approach through controversial means, rowdyism, using the arts, movies, coercion, cyberspace, and such things. Not having logical reasoning, it promotes its own opinions and approaches using the various tools at its disposal. It is not willing to take part in discussions, nor is it prepared to answer questions. The reason for this is that the West has no logical reasoning. There is no logic behind the worsening, ever-increasing, ridiculous approach to women's issues prevalent in the West today, as well as in many countries that follow the West. Therefore, it refuses to discuss this matter and is unwilling to provide any reasoning for its actions. Why is it that a disregard for maintaining the dignity and femininity of women in Western societies is increasing on a daily basis? Why is it that women are disrespected more and more every day? Why is it that a scantily clad woman can attend the official gatherings that are held in Europe and the US, even their official meetings, but a man must be fully clothed? He must even wear a tie or a bow tie in order to participate. Why? Why can a woman show up like that? But if a man wears shorts in formal gatherings, for example, this is considered to be a bad etiquette.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
education on Sundays.